We're going to talk about climate change denial this hour. Not just the denial that it's happening, or those who believe it's a hoax or entirely natural, but those who believe it's happening and don't do anything about it. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why would well-educated people who believe in science make few, if any, changes in their lives that would lower their greenhouse gas emissions or otherwise fight climate change? Have you made any changes? Are you worried about climate change? Are you working to fight it? Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. She is Kari Norgaard, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Oregon. She is the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life. She'll be participating in a Skype conversation this afternoon at UW Superior, and there are details on a link on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's good to have you here. Well, what are you going to be? Give us a preview. What are you going to talk with UW Superior about today?
Thanks. Well, there's, you know, for a long time been quite a bit of consensus and quite a bit of information about the seriousness of climate change, you know, the degree of threat to our ecological systems and so forth. And there's sort of a important debate happening amongst the scientific community and elsewhere about why is the public not taking this more seriously. It seems as though people, you know, just can't really be bothered. And, of course, on the one hand, there's, and it's been a growing issue in the United States, of people who say it's not happening. But there's a larger percentage of people who do believe it's happening, and those people are not doing much at all either. And so why not?
Yeah.
And my book is a response, actually, to what has been the dominant answer to that question, which is that people just don't know. They, you know, the information is too complicated, or they just don't care. They can't be bothered. And my book gives a different answer to that.
Yeah, we will talk about that. In fact, what is your answer? Why aren't people taking this seriously enough?
Well, the work I did is based on interviews and ethnographic observation in both Norway and the United States. And so from listening to people and watching and asking what was going on, I honed in on the role of very disturbing emotions, so especially guilt, fear about the future, and the sense of helplessness that people described in trying to think about climate change. And so my work focuses on how disturbing emotions, if nobody wants to feel, how we normalize them, how we through practices of everyday life, like changing the topic or, you know, not reading the newspaper, whatever they are, how those practices then are the way that we normalize it and kind of, as one person said, people want to protect themselves a little bit and sort of put his hands in front of his face as he was saying this. And so, you know, if there's very disturbing emotions, not just around climate change, but around many things, atrocities, human rights violations, people don't want to think about it. It can be overwhelming.
Well, the book you wrote does focus on your research in this community in Norway. What did you learn there about how people responded to climate change?
Yeah, so the work, I chose Norway. I'm third generation Norwegian American myself, and I've lived there and, you know, been very fascinated by a lot of things that seem possible there, actually, that didn't feel possible in the United States. You know, from the high standard of living or the high status of women. And when I started getting interested in this question, I thought Norway would be a really valuable place to think about things that might be more complicated in the United States. So the effects of climate change are more visible in the far north. Norway is a much smaller country with a lot more political participation. So some of the general disillusionment with the political system that we have in the United States is just not as much of an issue there. Norwegians are also very highly educated. They have the highest level of newspaper readership in the world. And so a lot of the things that you might say, well, you know, Americans just don't know the facts, or, you know, we have huge social inequality here, you know, but Norwegians have a very high standard of living. You know, people just can't be bothered because they're too consumed with, you know, getting through the day. And so I chose to work in this one community there. And basically, in that the year I was there, the snow was 2 months late. The lake where people would often ice fish, you know, someone died, just drowned walking along near it. And so despite these different things that were very unusual happening in the weather, people really didn't talk about it or make it a political issue. And, you know, I went to the political meetings of all these different groups of people and then eventually did a bunch of interviews and so forth. Yeah. And so I talk about the idea of something being both unimaginable and common knowledge at the same time.
That's interesting. So everybody believed in climate change, or most people believed in climate change. They believed that human activity had something to do with it. They knew that there could be dire consequences, yet they couldn't be bothered with it?
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing that, you know, especially at the time in Norway, there really wasn't the kind of climate skeptic movement that we had in the United States, and there really was a strong consensus. I never spoke to anyone who sort of questioned whether what they were seeing was related to climate change, but it just, you know, there was no political action. There were real economic consequences for the town, which had a lot of its income from this small ski area and the ski tourism that came with that. But, you know, when you go and talk to people at the political meetings, when you read the newspaper, it's as though nothing was happening. I want to make clear, I'm interested in the sense of sort of not responding, not only in terms of, you know, say whether you or I decide to ride the bus more, but also, you know, do cities have climate action plans? Do public agencies, are they planning for, you know, the kinds of effects that we're going to be looking at in terms of, you know, it's different in different communities, increased asthma rates or threats to water supplies, or so denial not just of, you know, individual people, which is part of it, but also, you know, agencies, which has been slow. We're seeing some response now for sure, but it's pretty slow compared to the seriousness and the degree of consequences that we're coming up against.
Yeah, so individual denial and societal or municipal denial, not doing things. But mm-hmm. But why is it? I mean, you said it was emotions like guilt and fear and helplessness. That's why people in Norway in your research were, I guess, not taking climate change so seriously or not doing anything about it?
Yeah, and I do have a chapter on the United States, and I talk about some of the things, you know, I did a number of interviews and so forth in the U.S. and talk about, you know, some comparison. But in both cases, those three emotions of guilt, a sense of helplessness, and fear about the future were identified by people, you know, that I spoke to.
And, well, why wouldn't they say, I'm afraid for the future, therefore I must, you know, do things differently?
Mm-hmm. Yes, excellent question, and that's what we would hope for, of course. And so there's a, you know, very strong theory in psychology of cognitive dissonance, and, you know, fear can bump up against what psychologists tell us is a universal need to have a sense of security, ontological security, and so forth. Guilt can bump up against our sense that we're good people, either individually or as a country, and helplessness, which can be combined. You know, climate change is not something that individual people can fix, mm-hmm. and so we look to our governments. And if you don't feel that there's a political system that's going to be up to the task, either nationally or internationally, which this is certainly an international problem, then there's a strong sense of helplessness, and people. We are motivated to, you know, feel that we have power to make a difference in the world, a sense of self-efficacy. And so my work is about, you know, I draw on psychology, but I am actually a sociologist. So I look at these emotions in the context of our larger system. So, you know, Americans or Norwegians who have a higher contribution to emissions, that's connected to the sense of guilt. Or for Americans, a sense, if depending on how much faith they have in the political system, that's going to be connected to a sense of helplessness. So it's a youth psychology, but I'm actually also talking about what we're doing at the collective level and how our larger circumstances is also playing out in terms of what we feel, the emotions that we feel.
Yeah. Well, I know that we're talking primarily here about individuals and communities that do believe in climate change and I guess man-made climate change having a lot to do with it. What about the denial movement that this is just, you know, it's a hoax, or it's completely natural and nothing to worry about?
Yeah. Well, I haven't studied that, so I don't have any, you know, of my own research based on that. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the same emotions of fear are underlying this. I mean, I think the climate change, you know, poses an enormous threat to our social and economic structure, our energy sources, I want to say our meaning systems, and that can play out for people in a variety of ways. There's been excellent work done on, you know, the climate, you know, the organizational aspects of the climate skeptic movement and where the funding comes from and how it's organized. You know, very, very, very good work. Naomi Oretzky, a historian, has done some. Riley Dunlap, a sociologist. Robert Brule is doing good work. But that's not really my area.
Well, you know, in the news, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently released a fairly dire report about climate change, saying the worst is yet to come, and it included even threats to the world's food supply. So might this get people and communities to respond to something that's that serious?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's, again, the new report is showing more and more consensus. It shows faster things for certain, you know, certain parts of how the climate system's changing, gives us updates. But it is the same, you know, the same kind of very significant. I mean, the fact that there are threats to our food and water supplies, you know, the U.S. government is very concerned. The Pentagon had released a serious report some years ago about, you know, global security threats as a result of this, you know, sea level rise. The sea level is, some parts of the United States has already risen up to 8 inches, and other places it drops. But, you know, these are very serious, and this has been the big question is, how come, given this information and the degree of certainty we now have about it, there's such silence in the public? And, you know, the assumption has been, if we just give people information, if we just give them information, you know, they will respond. And my work is saying, well, there is a place where, you know, we have a really strong capacity when it feels too overwhelming or too terrifying, we have a capacity to ignore that. Of course, the reason I did this work is I think, you know, we have to figure out how to mobilize people, how to make it such that a greater number of us really realize before, you know, while we still have time to act.
We are talking with the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life, about why well-informed people who believe in science-based climate change are in a sense essentially denying this, not making any changes that might lower their carbon footprint. They're not mobilizing to change climate change. What about you? Are you making changes? Are you working for an answer? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why don't more of us act on climate change? That's what we are discussing this hour with Kari Norgaard, who is an associate professor in sociology at the University of Oregon. She is the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life. She will be part of a Skype conversation this afternoon at UW Superior about her book. More information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's go to the phones. Carol in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Morning. Why do you think we don't do more to...
Well, I have two ideas. Mm-hmm. One is that on a political level, the very people who buy off the system are the same ones who are causing global warming or are helping through fracking and things like that. The very people who give the money to the politicians are the very ones like maybe Exxon. I don't know exactly the names and so on, but our whole political system is not working right. And the other reason that I got an idea of is on an individual level, we have a culture of individuality, and if someone does something against their own economic interest or against their own interest in certain ways, they are either thought of as crazy or they're thought of as not as good as other people. If we're not selfish, we're looked down upon.
Well, interesting. A couple of different things to talk about there. Kari, maybe starting with that last one first, that very individualistic society, and we're looked down upon if we don't follow the pack.
Thank you. I think, Carol, that's very insightful. And actually, both of those aspects of what you said are things that I write about, sort of how that fits in with what I'm seeing in terms of the sort of the normalization or the sense of, you know, why bother. And I think definitely in the United States we do have social norms around, you know, how to behave and how to talk and how to act. And one of the things that I talk about is how these social norms are part of what keeps this all in place. And I think you're exactly right that sense of, and I think you said it so well, you know, that people will be looked down upon or seen as crazy for doing things that might seem not to be part of our interest. And yet, of course, interest, what's in our interest is socially defined too. And certainly, you know, there's economic analyses. The most important economic analyses of climate change show that the cost of not acting is much, much greater than the cost of the cost of delaying action is what's making it all the more expensive. And yet, you know, on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis, you know, because I also talk in the book about the idea of the social organization of time, of sort of how we live, you know, and others, of course, talk about this too, but how our sense of time is very, very short. We're often just trying to make it through the day, and so that causes us to, but that's part of how we collectively create a world in which we're not thinking, in which climate change doesn't seem real.
Yeah. Are we saying, you know, yeah, I know the temperature is going up, and I know that's going to affect, you know, our climate and many different issues here, but, you know, I got to put food on the table, and I've got to, you know, I've got my life to live, and it'll happen down the road, and people of, you know, that generation will deal with it. Is that what we're doing?
I mean, I think it would be very interesting to do cross-sectional interviews with, you know, different communities in the United States and different age groups. I mean, I certainly hear people say things like that, and I think that is part of what's happening. There's, you know, that we can think about, though, sort of back to Carol's point of, you know, people sort of wanting to, the way that people are treated if they seem to be not individualistic or, that we do put other sort of public issues. You know, you just mentioned the minimum wage, which, of course, affects many people directly and many other people less directly. It's something that many people fight for, work for, because they, you know, they care about poverty in the United States, not just their own circumstance, but a larger collective social problem. And certainly there ought to be circumstances
under which we could care about the social problem that climate change is now, but also the one that it will be very clearly in 10 years. And I'd like to actually respond quickly to the first part of what
right.
you articulated, because I so appreciated both how, Carol, how you mentioned the, you know, the larger structural level and the individual. And I think it's exactly right. At the larger structural level, you know, it's not so much whether I get on an airplane or a car today to do something as it is, you know, what are the larger sources of fuel? Are we burning coal? Are we, you know, what are the auto vehicle emission standards? What, you know, what's happening at the national level? And the fact that we are, instead of toning things down, we're expanding into more and more energy-intensive fuel sources, you know, is not something that individuals can change, although collectively we sure can. And it wouldn't need to be all of us. It just needs to be enough people saying, you know, this is not... this is not in our interest to do this.
And we do see that, though, for example, with people who are protesting and trying to get President Obama to stop the Keystone Pipeline.
Yeah, there has been more more social activism around climate change in the United States, for sure, in the last 5 years. And I think that that's a sign that, to some extent, this is, you know, shifting. And I just, you know, when I talk about the idea of denial, I'm thinking of it, you know, as the elephant in the room that people are tiptoeing around in many ways. You know, there's many things we could do. I don't think, I know that we don't all need to protest the Keystone XL pipeline, but the fact that people, you know, are not doing, that's still seen, you know, as maybe more extreme. But on the other hand, like I said, you know, the planning by municipalities for what are going to be the conditions that their community will have to respond to in 10 years, in 5 years, you know, even family members talking about it. So when you look at, you know, it did become somewhat of a presidential issue more recently, but it's been, I first took an entire course on climate change myself in 1988, and it was first on the front page of the New York Times in 1988, and or maybe 89, and it has not been considered, and is still not one of the top sort of, if you look at Gallup survey data of what is the public concerned about, it's pretty low down.
Yeah.
That's the kind of sort of wide range of response that I think we need to have.
Here's a comment from Chuck in McFarland. He emails, whether climate change is a good or bad thing is a political question unless I'm being directly affected, which I am not. What the optimal mean global temp should be and whether we are moving closer or farther to it are also political questions. Elected officials should not let a consensus of scientists trump our political process. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think that this is a different kind of response than what, you know, this is somebody, I think, who's questioning that climate change is actually occurring, although maybe they're just on the fence, which is a different kind of constituency than what that most of my work is on. But I would say that, you know, that the framing of climate change as a political issue is something that's been attempted, you know, to try to keep people from responding, and that this is something that, you know, we have the ability to think in the slightly, you know, longer-term future. And, you know, if we know that smoking causes cancer, although many of the same people that are trying to say that the climate change is a political issue were some of the very same PR firms actually worked for a long time to try to obscure the link between smoking and cancer. So, you know, I think that there's been a movement to try to convince people that this is not a personal and that it's a political issue. I also, it's certainly true that, you know, what we think of as close to home, you know, is dependent on our sense of space and time. Even whether you define something that affects you, there have been many, many instances of extreme weather events in the United States just this last year, many instances, which, you know, we can say with a pretty high degree of certainty are linked with climate change at this point, but the whether or not those people see them as such, you know, it's all very it's complicated in that sense, and the media is a very important player here as well in how we interpret the things that are happening. So,
speaking of the media, let me bring Connie and Portage on. Hello, Connie.
Hi, good morning. It's funny that you're talking about this because this morning I was watching television, and I usually watch the local ones, and I thought I flipped over to Fox News, and they were talking about this, but they were laughing, and they thought it was hysterical that there was anything called global warming. And so I turned over to Morning Joe, and the same thing was going on. So I think and there are a lot of people that watch Fox News, and I think politics has a lot to do with the global warming and whether we get anything done, because all your corporations own all the media. And what do they want? They want the fracking. They want the oil. And so personally, I get very discouraged. I don't think a thing will be done about it. And I think it's a very serious problem. So that's my comment.
Thanks very much, Connie. A response to that, Kari?
Connie, thank you so much. Yes, I mean, I think exactly what you said, the discouraging. So, you know, back to in the beginning, I think there's a, you know, the type of phenomenon, you know, the type of denial that I work on is not that of people who, you know, who say it's not happening. But there's actually a larger percentage of us in the United States who do believe it's happening but aren't doing much. And I think that for those of us in that category, pointing the finger at the sort of climate skeptic movement and the people who don't believe it, saying that's the problem, is also an easy out. I mean, the discouragement is real. I think it's universally felt. But I do believe we still live in some kind of a democracy where people, the silence of the majority of us who do take it seriously has a significance.
Yeah. So what role should the media have in getting, prompting the appropriate action when it comes to climate change?
Well, that's a great question. again, you know, I mean, I'm, this is, you know, the research that I, you know, I'm sort of just want to speak from the research that I've done, the things that I know, but certainly one of the things I wrote about that I think is part of creating the sense of denial is when the media do not make linkages between different events so that we end up seeing everything as an isolated phenomena. So making linkages between extreme weather events, between, you know, there's the work that came out after Hurricane Sandy, the idea that it's not necessarily that each storm, you know, there is a difference between weather and climate. Climate is the sum total of, you know, the things that are happening. But at this point, and, you know, making the analogy of a pitcher or a batter on steroids, and that, you know, you can't say that any one particular thing that happens is a result of those steroids, but you know that overall that person, their game is going to change. And, you know, having that kind of understanding and making those, you know, relationships is certainly important. I think that coverage of the kinds of things that people are doing, it'd be helpful for cutting through the discouragement that that the last caller mentioned, which is, I think, again, you know, related to the sense of helplessness that I was talking about, that discouragement is very paralyzing. You know, why bother? Let's just go have another margarita or try to live as best of a life as we can because, you know, things are not good, as opposed to feeling like it's worth it to try to give our best for the world.
Yeah. All right. It was the fifth coldest winter in history in Wisconsin. And we have talked about this on the program, that just because it was a cold winter in Wisconsin does not mean temperatures globally are not going up. So we tried to certainly talk with that on the air. But it was so cold, people wanted to get out of Dodge because it was so cold. And I did that. I jumped on a jet plane and I went to Belize. And now, should I feel guilty that I took an airplane to a warmer climate because I wanted to get out of a brutally cold winter?
That's a great question. I mean, it really has to do kind of with, you know, there's, of course, the impact of any one person doing that is negligible. And I think at this point, you know, what we need to do to lower our carbon emissions is kind of all of the above. The caller that, you know, spoke about people, you know, the real people who have the ability to make large-scale climate decisions. It is, you know, it's not you and I. If all Americans stopped driving completely, it would not stop the problem that we have. And so it's important to be aware, I think, of we often have a real focus on individual actions. And it's not that individual actions don't matter, but they are really not the game at the moment. The real game in town has to do with developing a strong national policy, having you know, strong international standards, having plans for how municipalities can move forward to lower emissions, you know, all the things at that kind of level. So, you know, is it bad for the atmosphere that you did that? Sure. But is the most important thing for you to do if you're concerned about climate change to stop air travel? I don't believe so. I think that what people need to do is begin really talking about what it means and talking about the way forward and the way out and creating a political dialogue about what we are moving towards and how to get there rather than, you know, just thinking about sort of individual action.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Candy in Eagle River. Hello, Candy.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for the program. This is such an important topic.
Thank you.
It seems to me that, well, first of all, I think certainly climate change, the point that it is such a huge problem can be overwhelming. But it seems to me that quite often we do not make the connection between our diet and carbon emissions. And some years back, I know the Intergovernmental Panel came out with a paper regarding this concerning the connection between climate change and animal agriculture. And there is just a huge impact, whether it's our land use, the fossil fuels used in the whole process. And I would just like to encourage people that from an individual standpoint that actually transitioning to a plant-based diet is one of the most important things we can do. My husband and I made a switch about 20 years ago, and to be honest, it was really more from a health standpoint. But over the years, we've done a lot of reading, and it just seems to be a quite elegant solution to many problems because adopting a plant-based or mainly vegetarian diet has such positive impacts on our health and on the environment, certainly on climate change, that I would just encourage everyone to consider this. And there are many wonderful resources on the Internet to help us do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Candy. I have a vegetarian diet, so I started 20 years ago myself, but it wasn't necessarily for climate change reasons. What about that, Kari? Is that an individual action that might make a difference if more of us adopted a plant-based diet?
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I think it's great to realize the different ways that our carbon impact comes from, and I really appreciate the caller for that as well. And the other thing it made me think of as she was talking is that, you know, back when I took this whole course in college around climate change in 88, we really didn't have the degree of certainty that we had now about what was happening. And so a lot of the emphasis was thinking about things that were win-win, things that make your life better, or either at the individual level, as the caller was sort of talking about, and things that are better for society. And I think that that's a way that climate change actually is an opportunity for us. You know, there are many things that many people have been disillusioned about the way our society is, and this can be an opportunity. You know, things are, we've reached a point where it's clearly untenable, and So it can be an opportunity for us to radically revision and move towards things that are good, either in our personal lives, you know, the example of diet, for health reasons, for environmental reasons beyond climate change, for climate change, you know, for the certainly the condition of, you know, the term for, you know, factory farming and all of that is horrific in terms of animal welfare. There are, you know, many, many benefits. And it's also, agriculture is a big part of our climate emissions. And it can be meaningful and empowering for people to do things in their personal life. I think that, you know, I do want to, because we have such a discourse in the United States about individual action, I want to keep reminding us that at this point, we need to think about the structural piece. You know, what are the ways that we could get more people to do that, such as providing, you know, education in schools around whatever it is, you know, sort of think about the individual piece and then think about what would be a structural piece that people could put some energy into as well.
We are talking with Kari Norgaard. She is a sociology professor at the University of Oregon. She is the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life, which is a book she wrote about how well-informed, well-educated people who believe in climate change don't really do anything about it. They know it's happening and that it's not good, but they don't necessarily make any individual changes or don't really work for structural or community change either. What about you? Are you, in essence, denying climate change by not doing anything? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with our guest, the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life. Kari Norgaard will be having a Skype conversation with UW Superior participants this afternoon. You can get more information on that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's share this email from Patty. Not only is there great fear regarding the ramifications of climate change, but we are living in a country where it has been politicized. Half of our leaders are in denial because if they admit that global warming may be true, they would be removed from office. How can individuals do anything when their leaders are incapable of acting? What's your reaction to that, Kari?
Wonderful, wonderful. And again, I think this ties in exactly to the thing that I was saying, that sense of hopelessness or helplessness that people experience. And again, in the chapter in the United States, I talk about how this, I think, is particularly true in this country where we have such a large political system. There's so much money involved, and there's a lot of sense of alienation from that. And so exactly why bother? And in fact, what even can one do? And therefore, a lot of the silence is because there isn't a clear sense of what people can do. And part of the reason I think that we, you know, becomes very circular. There are actually, I think, things that are worth doing. And
like what?
Yeah, and things, you know, sometimes you don't know that what will happen, but it can be worth doing. And that one of the things that we need to do is start having a conversation about what is worth doing. You know, having, and this is sort of where I'm, you know, talking about the importance of the lack of people just even talking about climate change in everyday life is part of sort of perpetuating this whole sort of silence. So, you know, so what are the things that are worth doing? I think it's worth tuning in, being aware of what the data are in your local community. You know, what are the predictions for the next 10, 15 years? What many cities and municipalities, excuse me, are developing action plans. Local people can become involved in them. It makes a difference. You know, one of the things that's happened because we've had such a failure on the national level for action is the mayor's climate initiative began. I forget what year that happened. And that's where many cities across the country, cities decided that they were going to start doing things. States also have things, begin different kinds of action plans and planning things that are in development. And you know, those kinds of things obviously are not going to fix global emissions, but they can do a number of things that could work us towards that. For one thing, as extreme weather events happen, as water patterns shift, it's going to affect people along the way. You know, there's not sort of going to be one moment that climate change affects each of us. It's going to affect us via water supplies, via energy outages, because grids are not adapted to the types of energy usages that we're going to see. And so realizing and figuring out what your local city is going to do and becoming involved in that can be meaningful in terms of the interim quality of life that we have. It can also bring people together where they can start feeling that they're less alone in this and may motivate people to be getting involved in other things. I certainly think that it is extremely important that we have, you know, social movement activity like we spoke about earlier. I think it's very important that we have that. It's very important that, you know, when Gallup is calling up people, that people say climate change matters, because that sends a signal to the top about what is politically acceptable to do or not do.
Let's go to Grace in New Glarus now. Hello, Grace.
Hi. Thank you very much, Dr. Norberg, for your work and for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you found it useful. I hope you do.
Well, I made my commitment to the environment on the very first Earth Day, publicly. Led the assembly in our school that day. I was in eighth grade.
Woohoo!
So I became a wildlife ecologist, and I've done my focus in my later education was on epidemiology, and part of what I was looking at was introduced pathogens and how climate affects the distribution of even things like mosquitoes, and how we can expect more outbreaks in this country of things like yellow fever and malaria.
Right.
As the weather warms up, it's a friendlier climate for mosquitoes.
That's exactly true.
But before you even came on, I dialed in. And so I had no idea that you were going to be talking about how people's fear paralyzes them. And even that, I think that the findings of your research, I think I had come to intuitively that when people are afraid of a change, even though they get the idea that, yeah, it's going to happen, that I can't do anything about it, I'm scared of it, I can't change, I'm just going to shrink into myself and not do anything. We have to get young people properly educated and involved. Even a child of 7 or 8 years old can say something to a parent that changes the way they look at the world around them and changes their behavior.
Yeah.
So one of the things when I first really started hearing about climate change and people started talking about it, even though I was in college for the sciences, I had trouble understanding what some of the people were telling me. So the message has to be couched in very concrete terms. As you said, there have to be linkages made. You know, how does using an incandescent light bulb increase our carbon footprint versus using a fluorescent light bulb? How does growing your own food or buying local decrease the usage of fossil fuels throughout the country?
Yeah, and because we're coming close to the top of the hour, thank you very much, Grace. Kari, should we be having better messages and more education so people truly understand the linkages and the consequences?
You know, yes, I think we certainly do need more of that. I think we need we need more just general conversation. We need to be talking about climate change more in every aspect of our everyday lives and understanding and seeing those relationships. I also think, though, one of the probably most important things we need to talk about, we talk about educating ourselves or our children, has to do with talking about a way forward. And, you know, it's not clear. There's certainly no guarantee, but we're not even talking about, you know, I mean, there are people who are, but as a broader public, you know, what are the things that we can do? What are the things that are meaningful to do for different reasons, you know, in the short term, in the long term, you know, on a daily basis? Because I think that there's a danger of just putting it onto our young people, which is, you know, it is so overwhelming, and we see this, I think, that young people are very overwhelmed with, you know, the state of the world. And so we need to, you know, have a collective conversation, not just about, you know, the fear, but where we're going to as an antidote, and to see other people in that conversation with us. That those, both of those things can break up the fear and the helplessness, I think.
I would think that the fear of more mosquitoes in Wisconsin would would motivate people, especially those with the yellow fever. I don't mean to make light of it, but let's...
No, this is very, very good.
Charles on Facebook says, is there a sociological connection between climate change denial and Christianity? Many executives of America's biggest polluters and many elected officials follow an apocalyptic branch of conservative Christianity that happily anticipates the end times because they believe that would mean Jesus Christ would return. Huh, any idea?
Again, that's not, it's a very interesting question. It's not the focus of my work, so, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I would not be surprised, and I wish I could think off the top of my head of somebody who's done, you know, work more in that community. What I will say, you know, though, is that all of the world's religions have reinterpreted their texts in light of environmental messaging, and that there's a recent book, I believe it's co-edited, by a Canadian sociologist, Randy Halluza-Delay, that is on climate change in Christianity or climate change in religion. And so there are, you know, there are many things happening simultaneously, but I certainly would suspect that what the caller, the person is commenting about is a factor.
Well, let's, last question, last minute. Are you optimistic that we can, I guess, overcome our emotions and do something about climate change?
That's a great question. I don't know that I'm optimistic, but I don't think we get to give up. I think that we have to keep trying, that we owe it to ourselves and each other and our future, that we, you know, even if the odds don't look particularly good, that we don't get to give up, that we get to keep trying, and that there are many positive experiences we can have, community, many good things that can happen from not giving up, even when things don't seem to be certain.
Thank you very much for being with us. Kari Norgaard is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. She is the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life. And she will be a part of a Skype conversation with a UW Superior audience later this afternoon. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.